Honey, if we swoop in and wreck everything, that should seriously cramp his war-making ability. Oh, just wreck it. Just like that. Clegg jabbed a finger at the sidebar. With 3 cruisers and 8 destroyers ready to take exception? Actually, we think now that it's just 2 cruisers and 5 or 6 destroyers, in addition to the freighters, Travis said. And 3 of them might be Silesian Ordra-class frigates. But you're right, of course. No matter what the exact details, there's still no way we could take all of them on. Succinct analysis, Teo, Clegg said acidly. So what are you recommending? That we head back to Manticore and ask Admiral Locatelli to loan us a couple of battlecruisers? Travis winced. If Manticore was even still there. We could do that, ma'am, he said. But with a 5-month round trip, plus whatever time it takes to prep an expeditionary force, there's a good chance Jensen would be back, possibly with his entire fleet by the time we were ready.
And I don't think that's a battle the Royal Manticoran Navy's ready for, Chomps said soberly.
Agreed, Clegg said. So you're dropping this one in my lap? Not entirely, ma'am, Travis said, suppressing his reflexive annoyance at her tone. One way or another, of course, it was already in her lap. She was the captain, and no matter what happened, the final decision would be hers. We have another suggestion.
Well?
Travis braced himself. She wasn't going to like this.
We know Hammond's search schedule, and we know Kane's been tasked with finding Jensen. If we can find him and—
You can stop right there, Commander. Clegg cut him off. Are you seriously suggesting we bring a freighter, a foreign freighter, into our mission? And even if Kane was willing, you think even a Q-ship will magically change those odds?
She pointed again at the sidebar.
I don't think Kane is alone, ma'am, Travis said. He'd been right. She hadn't liked it. His last message mentioned other Andermani in Silesia. I'm guessing there are more Q-ships, possibly even a warship or two tucked away somewhere.
He never mentioned warships.
No, but they have to be here, Travis said. You heard how Kane talked about Jensen. They want him badly, and they surely wouldn't risk running an intel mission that might spook him unless they were ready to follow up with an immediate attack.
And you assume they think that way, why?
Oh, right, she added before he could answer. Because that's the way you would do it.
With an effort, Travis pushed back his anger. Clegg was smart, efficient, and experienced. Why couldn't she see the logic here? Or wasn't it the logic she couldn't see past? Was it her animosity toward Travis himself, along with Special Order 7, that was getting in her way? Probably. And that meant he was endangering the mission. Just by being who he was endangering the mission. He looked helplessly at Chomps.
I was just thinking, ma'am, the chief spoke up thoughtfully. That comment Kane made at the end, the one about cooperation, including reasonable joint military support.
What about it? Clegg demanded, her eyes still on Travis. It was pretty clear he was talking about some kind of official Andermani Manticoran operation at some vague future time.
That's what I assumed too, ma'am, Chomps agreed. But he's a reservist, not an official member of the Andermani government. He shouldn't even be making suggestions like that, let alone something that sounds like a promise.
Almost unwillingly, Travis thought, Clegg turned away from him and looked at Chomps.
So you're saying that Kane is thinking like Long?
As Commander Long said, the Andermani want Jensen very badly, Chomps reminded her.
So what you're advising is that we go look for Hammond, hat in hand, figuratively speaking, and ask Kane to help us out.
More or less, ma'am, Chomps said. If he can't help us himself, he should at least be able to give us an introduction to whoever can.
For a moment, Clegg gazed at the image of the Volsung base.
You make it sound easy, she said. Only it's not. The Andermani want Jensen and the Volsungs dead.
Good, because that's what we want too, Chomps said.
Is it?
Clegg countered.
She transferred her glare back to Travis. Is it Long?
No, ma'am, Travis said.
Our primary objective is information on why Jensen attacked us. The Andermani may not care about that.
Very good, Clegg said, inclining her head microscopically.
So how would you go about making it their objective?
I don't know, ma'am, Travis admitted.
even though they think just like you do?
Travis felt his lip twitch.
I don't have diplomatic skills, ma'am, he hesitated, as I'm sure the captain has noticed.
Something that might have been a small smile twitched across Clegg's lips.
Indeed, the captain has, she agreed. Chief, how about you?
I'm no better than Commander Long, ma'am, Chomps said, shaking his head.
You just know better when to keep your mouth shut?
Yes, ma'am.
There was no doubting that it was a smile that now crossed Chomps's face. I'm sure he'll learn, ma'am.
If he lives long enough. Clegg gave a snort. I have to say, gentlemen, that if this is the best Calvingdale can do, SIS is already in pretty bad shape.
She cocked an eyebrow at Chomps.
Or will she learn, too?
I would never say such a thing about a peer, ma'am, Chomps protested mildly.
I'm sure you wouldn't, Clegg growled. I'll take your suggestions under advisement. Dismissed, both of you.
For a long moment after they left, Clegg stared at the office door. Then, huffing out a sigh, she turned her attention back to the display. There were many officers in the Navy who were gifted in managing people. She wasn't one of them. Granted, most of that was because many of the people she was supposed to manage were self-seeking careerists, or lazy, or just plain stupid. She'd been forced to deal with officers who were marking time while seniority pushed them steadily upward to positions they were unfit for. She'd had to lead enlisted personnel who were neither led nor driven to true competence in their own duties, watching them lapse into mediocrity. So what was it about Commander Travis Uriah Long that set her teeth on edge? Because he wasn't any of the things she'd grown to loathe. He wasn't incompetent or lazy or unmotivated. He was smart. He was dedicated. And sometimes he could be borderline brilliant. And in many cases, in many of their disagreements, he'd turned out to be right. Was that what bugged her about him? She hoped not, because that attitude would be the very depths of pettiness. Maybe it was his earnestness, or his stubbornness, or the way he shot off his mouth without thinking things through that drove her crazy. The problem was that, more often than not, her knee-jerk reaction was to do exactly the same thing. Going to Kane and the Andermani made sense. In fact, given the size of the Volsung force, it was really the only option she had. Mentally, she shook her head. What was that she'd said to Long about officers who didn't think through the logical implications? Long was a lieutenant commander who lacked people skills. Clegg was a captain. She really ought to be better at this than he was. Muttering a curse at herself, she keyed her intercom.
Bridge Woodburn,
the exo's voice replied. Clegg. She identified herself.
Pull up Harmon's itinerary and figure out where we can make rendezvous with her. Compute the two best options, plus a couple of alternatives in case she makes better time than Kane expected.
There was just the briefest silence.
Yes, Captain, Woodburn said, his voice studiously neutral. I'll send you the courses as soon as they're ready.
Thank you,
she keyed off the intercom. And sighed again. Long would undoubtedly feel relieved. And he and Townsend would both feel vindicated. Worse, they'd both know she'd changed her mind and succumbed to their logic, or at least to their arguments. Put one way, they'd know she'd recognize the validity of their suggestions and overcome her own resistance to accept them. Put another way, they'd know they'd manipulated her into doing things their way. But it didn't matter. The survival of the Star Kingdom was at stake. With that threat hanging over them, she could afford to let Long and Townsend think whatever they liked. She turned back to her computer, her mind filling with thoughts of strategy and tactics and diplomacy. Chapter 28. Elizabeth had known this day would come, but even with foreknowledge and mental preparation, some events could still deliver a shock. Today was one of them.
I had hoped this would not be necessary, Your Majesty, Breakwater said, his voice as grave and earnest as if he actually meant it. But my duty, and indeed the duty of all your ministers, is to the Constitution of the Star Kingdom. It is thus with a heavy heart that I must make the following statement.
He cleared his throat, and Elizabeth braced herself. Here it came.
unless your majesty takes a commoner husband within the next 30 days, so that the kingdom may be given an heir as prescribed by the constitution, I will be forced to submit a resolution to the House of Lords that will bring the whole thing into the open and force you to publicly address the issue."
It was as if a terrible weight had been lifted from Elizabeth's shoulders. 30 days. Breakwater had vacillated for 6 months on this issue, and now he was giving her another 30 days? It was like a gift from God. With 30 more days, assuming Joshua Miller was still willing,
"I understand, my lord," she said gravely. "I disagree entirely with your premise, but you must, of course, do what you think is right. As do we all."
"Of course, your majesty," Breakwater said. "And again, I regret that this has become necessary."
"I'll just bet you do."
"Again, I understand," Elizabeth said. "Thank you for your honesty."
She waited 10 minutes after he'd left the palace, just to be on the safe side. Then, with only a little trepidation, she screened Joshua.
"He's a real prince, isn't he?"
Joshua commented after Elizabeth brought him up to speed.
"Okay, so what do we do?"
"The same thing we have been doing," Elizabeth said. "At least now we've got a definite timetable and deadline."
"I suppose," Joshua said a bit doubtfully,
"though you know what stress can do to this sort of thing."
"Try not to think about it," Elizabeth said. "We'll just have to do what we can and hope for the best."
"Yeah, hope," Joshua rumbled. "I've never liked that word. I especially don't like having to hang my hat on it."
"I don't either," Elizabeth confessed. "But right now, it's all we've got."
"I suppose," Joshua said. "Do you want me to come over tonight? You think it'll do any good?"
"I think so, yes," Joshua said.
"Besides, if we make it work, we'll need to have some answers and statements ready. If we can't think of anything else, we can always work on that."
Elizabeth sighed. He always made it sound so clinical.
"That's a good idea," she said. "I'll send Adler. The usual time?"
"That will be fine," he said. "I'll see you later, Your Majesty,"
he belatedly added the obligatory honorific. Elizabeth smiled sadly. So very, very clinical. But that was her life now. That was the life of the Queen.
"I'll see you at 8 then," she said. "Goodbye, Joshua."
"Goodbye, Your Majesty."
The realities of space travel, particularly the fact that courier ships were no faster than warships, meant that a ship that came calling on a neighbor seldom, if ever, had the chance to announce her arrival in advance. If the warship was particularly large and threatening, or the neighbor was particularly nervous, that could create complications and diplomatic panic. A destroyer like Damocles wasn't particularly large or threatening, particularly to a system as well-armed and well-defended as Haven. Haven itself was certainly not the nervous neighbor type. Which made Haven Control's coolly formal communications both puzzling and, in Lisa's view, more than a little ominous. Surely the government and Republic Navy hadn't forgotten their successful joint venture at Secor 10 years ago, and should accord a visiting Manticoran ship a welcome that was warm, or at least cordial. The situation bugged her all the way in, and she was pretty sure Captain Marcello was feeling just as puzzled. Fortunately, they were nearly to Haven orbit when the reason was made clear.
"Because I wish to greet you in person, of course,"
Commodore Gustav Charnay said, his wide and expansive face beaming from the comm display.
"Please forgive my theatrics, but it is seldom that one has a chance to renew acquaintances with long-lost comrades in arms."
He cocked his head to the side.
"Though perhaps you don't remember me, Commander Donnelly. I was merely the XO of Saint-Ange under Commodore Jason Flanders, and sadly did not acquit myself as well as I might have."
"I don't think any of us started out looking very good, Captain," Lisa said diplomatically. She remembered Charnay quite well, in fact, but the years hadn't been kind to the man. "But once we caught on, we ended up all right."
"You're very kind to say so," Charnay said, inclining his head. "I trust that later you'll indulge my curiosity as to the lives and further careers of Captain Eigen and Commander Metzger."
"I'll be delighted," Lisa assured him, noting out of the corner of her eye the satisfied look on Captain Marcello's face.
Some commanders, she knew, would find it insulting to be effectively ignored while a more junior officer attracted this much attention. But Marcello had his eye firmly on the mission, and the more friendly and cooperative Haven's top people were with his officers, any of his officers, the better.
I'd also like to hear how Commodore Flanders has fared.
We shall make sure to have a time of reminiscences, Charnay promised. And perhaps a third will join us. Brigadier, are you there?
I'm here, Commodore, a familiar voice came.
The comm display split, and on the other half,
Colonel Massengill?
Lisa asked. The question was pure reflex. Aside from considerably more white in her hair, Massengill looked exactly as she had 10 years ago. Leaving Manticore to come work for the Havenites had clearly been healthy for the woman.
I'm sorry, I see it's Brigadier Massengill.
It's good to see you too, Commander, Massengill said with a smile. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I should acknowledge that I'm the one who asked Commodore Charnay to delay a formal welcome until I could arrive aboard Santange. As soon as I saw your name on the officer list Captain Marcello sent, I knew that I had to be here.
I'm glad you're here, Brigadier, Lisa said, mentally crossing her fingers.
Here was where all the warm fuzzies could suddenly disappear.
This isn't just a social call, or even a show-the-flag voyage.
Of course not, Charnay said calmly. It was obvious from the start that you'd come to discuss the attack on Manticore. That was the main reason Brigadier Massengill and I waited until now to speak with you.
There are some in the Nouveau Paris political sphere who would frown on assisting Manticore, especially if that aid took resources away from Haven, Massengill added. Fortunately, there's another side to that sphere.
She gave Lisa a half-smile.
Most of whom remember Secor very well.
Still, it's not something we wish to banter around freely, Charnay said. As far as the public is concerned, you're here to deliver your new sovereign's greetings and best wishes to the Republic.
He smiled.
And while Captain Marcello is wined and dined and endures speech after speech, perhaps Commander Donnelly, Brigadier Massengill, and I will have discussions of our own. Will that arrangement work for you, Captain?
Absolutely, Marcello said.
In fact, that was largely what I was going to suggest.
He inclined his head to Massengill.
The fact that Manticore would once again be privileged to enjoy Brigadier Massengill's services is an unexpected but welcome bonus.
More of a privilege than you know, Charnay said.
The Brigadier has become Haven's leading expert on the discovery, assessment, and elimination of pirate and black merc groups.
He raised his eyebrows.
So tell me, Captain Marcello, what exactly do you want from us?
We've brought you a small sampling of debris from the battle, Marcello said. Some of it appears to be Havenite in origin.
I presume you don't suspect us of direct involvement.
Not at all, Marcello assured him. Our thought is that either someone in the Republic is working with our mysterious Admiral Tamerlane, or more likely, Tamerlane purchased Havenite equipment somewhere along the line. Either way, we're hoping our attackers left a trail you can follow.
I presume it will be best for everyone if such inquiries are off the books, Lisa added.
Absolutely, Charnay agreed. If for no other reason than an official investigation might alert the wrong people.
He smiled, his eyes glittering with anticipation.
Let me screen the head of naval intelligence and find out what we can do.
The file was so obscure, so vague, and so old that Winterfall's search nearly missed it. But he did spot it, and a few evenings' worth of work took him all the way back to its source and a long-buried truth. A few more evenings' worth of talking to archivists and spinning stories, and he had a copy of the original document. It was explosive. Fusion bomb-level explosive. It might make the difference in Breakwater's quiet campaign to undermine the Queen. The problem was, Winterfall had no idea what to do with it. He couldn't just turn it over to the Lords. Not the entire body, nor any subset of it. He couldn't really take it to the Queen. He certainly couldn't go public with it. If the whole thing blew up, Winterfall's reputation and future would be well within the resulting blast zone. But he couldn't just sit on it, either. Breakwater's confrontation with the Queen was coming to a head, and everyone in government was figuring out where they wanted to be lined up when the fireworks started.
Winterfall had to find a way to get this to the right people, and he had to do it fast. There was only one person he could think of to turn to. His brother Travis had the kind of overdeveloped sense of duty that would surely put him on his sovereign's side in any political struggle. And he would probably know military people who could get the document in the right hands without leaving Winterfall's fingerprints on it. There was just one small hitch.
"No, he left here about 5 months ago," Travis's landlord said. "Happens all the time with Navy people."
Winterfall clenched his teeth. And the one time he not only wanted but needed to make contact with his brother, naturally, was the time his brother would be nowhere to be found. "Do you know when he'll be back?"
"Nope," the man said. "He paid rent for a year, which is a lot longer than they're usually gone. But even with shorter deployments, they're not always right about the timing. That's why the Navy has a rent payment guarantee, you see. That keeps us from just booting them out if—"
"Yes, yes," Winterfall interrupted him. "What about his friend, Lisa Donnelly?"
"No idea," he said. "She doesn't live in any of my buildings. But I think she shipped out about the same time Long did."
"And she'll be gone a year, too?"
"No idea," he said. "They don't exactly check in and out with me. You need to talk to someone in the Admiralty if you want that kind of information."
"I may do that," Winterfall said. "Thanks." Still, he reflected as he walked back toward his air car, it might not be a problem. Breakwater had said he would be giving the Queen an ultimatum soon, but he seemed to have changed his mind. Certainly, he hadn't said anything about the confrontation happening anytime soon. He hated to sit on this any longer than he had to, but maybe it wouldn't be so bad. Travis would probably be back in 7 months, and Breakwater had already dithered that long on this. If the Chancellor dithered another few months, Winterfall could still pull this off. And if, somewhere down the line, Breakwater informed him that the ultimatum's delivery was imminent, well, he would worry about that when it happened.
"Hello, Gavin."
Winterfall jumped, nearly wrenching his back as he spun around. Invisibly, inaudibly, Baroness Castle Rock had managed to come within 3 meters of him.
"My lady,"
he managed.
"You startled me." "Really? My apologies,"
she said, her lined face showing bemusement.
"I didn't realize I was walking so softly. What brings you to this neighborhood?"
Winterfall felt his face stiffen. Did she somehow know about his private research? What could he say? An instant later, he realized that he didn't have to come up with anything at all. He had the perfect reason to be here.
"I was hoping to drop in on my brother," he said.
"But the landlord told me he'd been deployed somewhere."
"Yes, out to Silesia,"
Castle Rock said, her eyes steady on his face.
"I thought you knew that."
"I'm afraid I'm not as good at keeping track of Travis as I should be," Winterfall admitted. "What about you? You have family or friends around here?"
"I enjoy long walks sometimes," she said. "You could have saved yourself a trip if you just screened him."
"Yes, I suppose I could have," Winterfall agreed. "Probably should have, too. But sometimes I just have to get out of the Lords. That place can drive even the sanest person crazy." Castle Rock smiled, but it was a perfunctory smile, without any warmth Winterfall could detect. And really, why should she offer him a genuine smile? She'd startled him, thrown a couple of perfectly innocent-sounding questions in his path, and watched him stumble over them. She knew something was up. Hopefully she hadn't guessed any of the details, but she'd certainly come to the obvious conclusion that it was probably something neither she nor Breakwater would like. Or maybe she had guessed the details. Maybe she, or Breakwater, was fully aware of his nighttime researches or his evening visits to archivists. And suddenly, Winterfall was freshly aware of the damning data chip in his pocket.
"It's not always a pleasant place," Castle Rock agreed, "but it's where the business of the Star Kingdom gets done. Speaking of which, I'm sure you have some meetings or debates you should be attending."
"Yes, I have one later today," Winterfall said, resisting the urge to slowly back away from her. He already looked guilty. There was no point in adding the appearance of panicked paranoia to the mix.
"Good," she said. "I'll see you back there then."
"Yes, my lady," Winterfall said. She gave him another perfunctory smile and turned away.
Winterfall watched her for a few steps to make sure she was actually leaving, then turned and continued on toward his air car. At least she hadn't called the police and had him searched. He had no idea whether she could make that work legally, but he was pretty sure she had tricks up her sleeve that he'd never heard of. Thankfully, he was off the hook, for now. But his time was running out. He had to find someone to pass this information to, and fast. In the meantime, he was still a member of Parliament, and he had a job to do. He would head back, and he would do that job. After all, the House of Lords was a big place. Surely he could avoid running into Breakwater or one of his cronies for the rest of the day. And later tonight, he would figure out what he was going to do. Chapter 29. Most business between the Lords and the Commons went via digital transfer, but occasionally there was a document that was deemed too sensitive or too cumbersome, and a courier was engaged to hand-carry the data chip between the two buildings. It took Winterfall a week to contrive such a document and to find a reason to deliver it himself. He hadn't been to the Commons for nearly 3 years, but as he walked the corridors, he could see that the place hadn't changed. Whereas the Lords always seemed to resonate with activity and purpose, the Commons seemed almost placid, even lethargic. On one level, it made no sense. When Queen Elizabeth I had taken over from her father, she'd worked hard to upset the neat little members-only governing club that the Constitution's framers had made of the House of Lords. The Queen had taken that carefully constructed centralization of power and spread it out to both the Commons and the Crown. The Lords had squawked furiously, but with the Commons' help, the Queen had forced it through. But on another level, it made perfect sense. Governing was hard work that required time, attention to detail, and sheer perseverance. Most of the peerage had been raised to think of themselves as leaders and governors, even those who had to split their time between Parliament and their day jobs. But most commoners hadn't. And so, despite the legacy of shared power that Elizabeth I had tried to leave them, over the years, the Commons had gradually ceded much of their power back to the Lords. Most of the Lords undoubtedly thought of that as a good thing, if indeed they thought about it at all. Winterfall himself was of two minds. Concentration of power was certainly more efficient, but it could also be more easily abused. Fortunately, political philosophy wasn't on today's agenda. All he had to do was deliver his data chip and a short message and get out, preferably without anyone important seeing him. His target office was in an otherwise unremarkable hallway. There was a name on the wall beside the door, but no secretary or other gatekeeper sat watch outside. Very unlike the circle of high-level lords he usually ran in. The door itself was half open. Taking that as a tacit invitation to potential interlopers, Winterfall tapped gently on the door and pushed it open. The office was smaller than Winterfall had expected, and only sparsely decorated. The man sitting behind the desk was equally unadorned, his jacket off, his neck wrap undone and hanging loose, his sleeves rolled partially up his forearms. But as he looked up, Winterfall had the sense that the man felt completely at home here.
"Can I help you?"
"Excuse me," Winterfall apologized. "The door was open.
You don't know me, Mr. Miller, but—"
"Oh, I know you, my lord," Joshua Miller interrupted calmly. "I dare say everyone in Landing knows you, at least those who follow politics. What can I do for you?"
"I need to ask you a favor," Winterfall said, reaching behind him and closing the door. Miller's eyes narrowed slightly as he did so, but he made no comment. "I have a document I need delivered to the Queen. I was hoping you'd do that for me." Miller's eyebrows went up a fraction of a millimeter.
"The palace really isn't that hard to find," he said. "Just ask someone on the street. They'll point you in the right direction."
"I can't take it to her myself," Winterfall said. Let's just say it's of a sensitive nature. I can't afford for there to be any public notice taken of the delivery.
So what makes you think there will be less notice if I take it?"
"Because I'm guessing the guards at the door are more familiar with you," Winterfall said. "They may let you in with less fuss."
"I think you've got the wrong person," Miller said. "I've been to the palace exactly twice, and the last time was 6 months ago. You want an unobvious courier, you'd do better to send it in with your patron, Breakwater. He's always walking the halls there.
Yes, Winterfall murmured, feeling his throat tighten. Yes, that would be a clever idea. But you're also a prominent MP. No one will worry if you let me see it.
Winterfall frowned. Miller's expression hadn't changed, but he was now holding out his hand.
Excuse me? Let me see the document. Will you take it to the Queen?
I can try, Miller said. I know a couple of people in the palace, but I'm not going to bother them until I know it's worth wasting their time over.
It can't go through anyone else, Winterfall warned. It has to go to the Queen directly.
Yes, I got that, Miller said. He wiggled the fingers of his outstretched hand.
The document?
Winterfall hesitated, a sudden surge of doubt freezing his resolve. Miller's speeches and Bill's submissions clearly showed that he was one of those who wanted the Commons to regain some of its eroded power. That was the main reason Winterfall had decided to approach him. On top of that, he was on Burgundy's list, so he must at least be a decent man. But even decent men could be ambitious for power, and the document in Winterfall's pocket cut in more than one direction. If Miller's true goal was personal power, with the restoration of the Commons' authority merely a means to that end, taking Winterfall's data chip elsewhere would guarantee him all the power he could ever want. And it would spell Winterfall's instant and permanent ruin. It was a risk, but then all of life was a risk. And eventually every man had to trust someone. Steeling himself, he pulled the chip from his pocket.
For the Queen, he said, placing it in Miller's outstretched hand.
Interesting choice of phrase, Miller said, peering briefly at the chip and then slipping it into his own pocket. Did you mean that in the sense of deliver it to the Queen, or more along the lines of a formal battle cry?
Actually, a little of both.
And to his mild surprise, Miller smiled.
I'll do what I can, my lord, he said.
No, better. I'll do everything I can.
Thank you, Mr. Miller, Winterfall said.
Good day to you, sir.
And good luck.
I'm bored, Hester Fife declared, folding her arms across her chest.
Really?
Lynn asked, eyeing her across the table.
Really?
Hester unfolded her arms and started pointing to the four chessboards set up between them.
I've won this one, and this one.
Really? Lynn said again, dropping his gaze to the boards. They were barely 10 moves into each of the games. And she was declaring victory already? Apparently so. The worst part was that she was probably right.
What about this one? He asked, pointing to the fourth board.
You could still win, she conceded. But you probably won't. You have a bad habit of only thinking 5 or 6 moves ahead, so you'll probably blow it. You usually do.
Well, let's at least give me a fighting chance, Lynn said, frowning down at the board. A minute ago, he'd been confident about his strategy. Now he probably ought to give his plan another quick review.
Whatever, Hester said. Can I reset these?
Sure, Lynn said, still mentally running through the moves. Go ahead. Normally, of course, he hated to lose. Hated it with a passion. But with Hester, he was willing to put his alpha male instincts aside. Partly it was because fighting against her in chess was futile anyway. But mostly it was because she was too valuable to be left to spin her wheels in frustration and boredom. Anything that kept her sharp, even if it was rolling boulders over him, was worth whatever pain it cost. And speaking of spinning wheels,
how are you doing on that other little problem I gave you? He asked as he eased his remaining knight to a cautious attack.
Oh, I'm finished,
she said as she pushed all the pieces to the side of the first board with the back of her hand, and began returning them to their starting positions.
I figured it out just before you traded me the bishop for the knight in the second game.
Lynn frowned.
So you haven't finished it?
Yes, I finished it, she said with strained patience. I just said that.
But you haven't broken the encryption yet?
Yes, I broke the encryption, she repeated, her patience even more strained. I just haven't written it down yet, that's all.
Ah. Lynn said. Had you a time in mind for doing that?
Oh, I don't know, she said, starting on the second board. After a couple more wins, probably.
I guess that'll work, Lynn agreed, making a mental note not to try too hard to beat her on this new round of games.
I don't know what you want Jensen's comm encryption broken for anyway, she added, pausing in her board resetting to counter Lynn's knight move with her rook. They're not really going to say anything important when you're close enough to tap in, are they?
You never know, Lynn told her, glaring at the rook. That was not the move he'd expected her to make. Jensen's arrogant enough to think he can get away with it.
And stupid enough to try?
Basically.
Idiots.
Shaking her head, she returned to her resetting. Don't disparage idiots, Hester, my dear, Lynn said. They're quite useful. Find a stupid person who thinks he's clever, and you can get him to do almost anything you want.
You mean like getting him to play chess all afternoon, even when he hates to lose?
Or like getting her to solve an encryption problem, even though she gets bored with the data work part of it? She gave him a startled look. Her shoulders rounded, and she lowered her gaze to the table.
That wasn't very nice, she said in a low voice.
I'm sorry, Lynn said, silently berating himself. The woman was a mathematical genius, but her sense of self-esteem was a piece of pie crust, and he of all people should know that. It was a joke. He reached over, put a finger under her chin, and eased her head up to face him again. Just like yours, he added, giving her a reassuring smile. She frowned, and then her face cleared.
Oh, right. Jokes. Because neither of us is actually stupid.
That's right, Lynn agreed, starting to breathe easier. We're not stupid, we're not expendable,
and we're not going.
She finished the old comedy routine line, grinning brightly now, the momentary hurt forgotten. The grin vanished into another frown.
We're not going, are we?
Not at all, he assured her. At least not all the way.
Good, she said. Because it doesn't sound like fun.
It'll be fun for us, Lynn said. Just another game. Like this one.
Right.
She gestured to the reset boards.
Ready?
Ready, he said, moving his king's pawn on the first board. And you'll program in the decryption coding right after the games, right?
Yes, she said, jumping her knight over her home row pawns. Right after the games.
Making rendezvous turned out not to be quite as easy as Kane had implied when he laid out his projected movements. It was no one's fault, really. Coordinating interstellar movements was hard enough, even when both ships had firmly fixed schedules. Coordinating them when neither side knew exactly when the other would reach a given point made it far more difficult. Clegg had known from the moment they left Walther that her window for catching Kane at Lao Healer would be a bit tight. But there should be enough time. Moreover, it was only 4 T-days in Hyper to Lao Healer, but 9 T-days to Zoxen, the next target system on Woodburn's list. If she caught Kane at Lao Healer, she could save 8 full days. If she missed him there, though, it would cost 10 more T-days to make the trip to Zoxen on his heels. As it happened, she didn't catch him at Lao Healer. Clegg sat in her command chair, glowering at the display. Travis sat at the TO station, trying not to make himself noticed. It was hardly his fault that Kane wasn't on his planned schedule, but he suspected Clegg would try to make it his fault just the same. Unfortunately, Pasha was Lao Healer's only inhabited planet. If Haman wasn't there, or on her way in or out, she wasn't likely to be anywhere else in the system.
Kill our acceleration, Exo, the captain said after a moment. Comm, is Pasha's station in laser range? Yes, ma'am, Lieutenant Solini Hira said. Lay a laser on the station and transmit a request for any stored messages. Aye, aye, ma'am. Transmitting now.
Travis checked the status board. Casey had been in system for 1 hour and 40 minutes, putting her roughly 5 minutes and 4.8 million kilometers inside the hyper limit, 62 million kilometers short of Pasha's orbit. At that range, a round-trip transmission delay was almost 7 minutes. Stifling a sigh, Travis, along with Clegg and everyone else on the bridge, settled in to wait. The 7 minutes passed, plus 4 more, before a soft chime sounded.
Transmission from Pasha Station, ma'am,
Hira reported.
Very good, Comm, Clegg said. Decrypt and switch to my display. Aye, aye, ma'am.
For a few seconds, Clegg gazed at her display. Surreptitiously, Travis looked at her, saw her eyes tracking back and forth as she read. Then her lips compressed briefly.
Missed him by less than 15 hours, Exo, she said, looking across at Woodburn.
Travis winced. 15 hours after a journey of 9 light-years. Clegg was not going to be happy. To his surprise, the expected explosion didn't happen.
I guess we follow them to Zaxxon, she added.
Assuming he's actually there, Woodburn said a bit sourly.
He will be,
Clegg said calmly. Captain Kane indicates his route hasn't changed. He just managed to clear Lao Healer almost 72 hours earlier than he'd anticipated. So we ought to catch up with him in Zaxxon. She glanced at Travis, with no particular emotion he could detect, then turned to the astrogator. Take us back across the limit, Ms. Lukanov, she ordered. Then put us on course for Zaxxon. 11 days later, Casey crossed the Zaxxon hyper limit and headed inward.
We'd better find some good news, sir, the ATO, Lieutenant Kojong Ip, commented from the TO spot. I think the captain's going to start chewing hull plates if we don't.
Watch what you say about senior officers, Mr. Ip, Travis warned. Under some circumstances, he would have let Ip's comment pass, but as officer of the watch, he had to maintain higher standards. Not that he disagreed with the ATO. Over the last few days, he'd watched Clegg's quiet tension slowly ramping up as they approached Zaxxon. Once, he would have assumed she was mad at him, or at Chomps, or at somebody aboard, and reacted with his usual approach of walking on eggshells and waiting for the explosion to happen. But after a long talk with Chomps 3 days ago, and some of the insight that the chief had that Travis sorely lacked, he finally understood. It wasn't just Clegg's natural irascibility, though there was certainly some of that in her personality. Mostly, it was her deep awareness that her actions here in Silesia would set the pattern for the entire RMN. Andermani captains like Kane served in a navy that routinely deployed its ships across multiple star systems, and had done so for years, cruising the interstellar lanes far from any immediate contact with superiors, was something to which they'd had ample opportunity to become accustomed. For that matter, back when Gustav Andermann had been perhaps the Salarian League's most successful mercenary commander, the ships under his command had never known where they might travel in any given month, or the month after that. The pattern for the Royal Manticoran Navy had been almost the exact opposite. Ever since the days of the Brotherhood's reign of terror, its ships had rarely left the home system. On the few occasions when they had, they'd usually gone in squadron or at least divisional strength. Clegg was breaking new ground here. She and Casey were on their own, farther away from home space than any RMN ship had ever before operated. Clegg wasn't simply Manticore's senior naval representative, but also its senior diplomatic representative. Her words, her decisions, her actions, all of them could have far-reaching repercussions for the Star Kingdom. If she committed herself too closely to a relationship with someone like Kane, perhaps creating expectations which Queen Elizabeth's government chose to repudiate, the consequences for future relations with the Andermani might be dire. By the same token, if she offended the Andermani by declining to cooperate with them, that could have equally serious repercussions. And those same diplomatic considerations apply to every other star system in the area that Casey visited. But stacked right alongside those were the military considerations. Casey had no support, no backup. If anything happened to her that couldn't be repaired with local resources, or if there was an ordinary operational accident, she'd be marooned in one of the local star systems until a relief could be sent from Manticore. If she was lucky, if she wasn't, Casey might simply disappear, never to be heard from again. And every bit of that responsibility devolved upon Captain Trina Clegg. She wasn't just a subject of the Star Kingdom of Manticore. She was the Star Kingdom of Manticore.
Whoa, there we go, sir,
Ip said, and there was no mistaking the relief in his voice.
Happy days, Commander.
Happy days indeed, Lieutenant, Travis said, gazing at SMS Haman's transponder beacon burning brightly on the plot. Zaxxon was a busier system than Lao Healer, with a more sprawling infrastructure, and Kane's message had explained that he would require more time here for his search. Currently, the Andermani freighter was orbiting Dresden, the system's single inhabited planet, and Travis wondered briefly how much of Kane's investigation he'd completed. He also wondered how Kane was going to react to what he and Chomps had discovered at Walther. He pressed the intercom button.
Clegg, the captain's voice responded. Long, Captain,
he said. We've just crossed the hyperlimit. We're picking up Harmon's transponder at 9.5 light minutes in Dresden orbit.
Very good, Mr. Long, she half grunted. Transmit our initial message. I'll be there in 5.
Aye, aye, ma'am. Captain Kane, to Travis's relief, was delighted to hear from them. He listened carefully to Clegg's report about Walther, asked a few questions, and seemed eminently satisfied with her answers. And then, instead of inviting them inward to Dresden, he suggested they all head out to the hyperlimit and follow him somewhere. Clegg had asked a few questions of her own. The only answers Kane would give boiled down to promising the journey would be well worth the Manticoran's time. For the past 16 hours, Casey had followed Haman through the Alpha Bands. Finally, 4.5 light days from Zaxxon, Kane signaled that they'd arrived. Haman apparently had a very good astrogator. After a moment's orientation, Kane announced they'd arrived 5 light minutes from their goal, and again invited Casey to follow. 2 hours of acceleration, followed by 2 more hours of deceleration. Travis gazed at the displays, listening to the silence of Casey's bridge, wondering what Kane was up to. And then, 10 minutes from their final destination, they began to see the lights. XO? Clegg invited. She was leaning forward in her seat, as if putting herself that much closer to the display would give her a better view.
There appear to be several ships out there, ma'am, Woodburn said. Lying to...
No wedges. They seem to be waiting.
For Kane? Clegg asked.
Or for us?
Hopefully both, Woodburn said, his voice coming through the speaker from CIC. Assuming those are running lights, that one closest to us is probably a cruiser. That one further back and to portside may be a battlecruiser. The two to starboard look to be a destroyer and another cruiser. And then, behind the frigate and battlecruiser, another set of running lights abruptly came on.
Travis caught his breath. What the hell was that?
XO? Clegg called.
Her voice was mostly calm, but there was a definite edge to it.
Tell me what we're seeing.
It's not a battlecruiser, ma'am, Woodburn said, his voice about as stunned as Travis had ever heard it.
It's too big, and we're reading too many launchers. Unless the Andermani have dreamed up some kind of customized hull.
He paused, and Travis could visualize him shaking his head.
Captain, I believe that is a genuine, honest-to-God battleship.
Someone on the bridge whistled softly. The sound broke Travis's own awed paralysis, and he keyed for the files.
That's impressive, Clegg said into the silence.
I was under the impression that only the League had warships that big.
T.O.?
That's what Janes says, ma'am, Travis confirmed.
According to them, the SLN's the only navy with battleships.
Apparently their bean counters missed one, Clegg said.
Yes, ma'am,
Travis agreed. And apparently he, Clegg, and everyone else aboard had seriously underestimated how badly Gustav wanted Jensen put out of business.
Come, let's open a hail, Clegg continued. See who we're dealing with here.
Already have one coming in, Captain, Chief Hira announced. It's from an Admiral Gotthold Riefenstahl, Graf von Basaltberg.
Thank you, Clegg said. Put him through.
The comm display lit up to show an elderly man with a lined face and a close-trimmed skull cap of pure white hair. His haircut, as well as his overall demeanor, reminded Travis of Jensen. But whereas Jensen's uniform had been hidden by a vac suit, with only the collar peeking out, Basaltberg's elaborate white uniform, edged in red piping and encrusted with gold braid, was on full and grand display.
Captain Clegg, the man's booming voice came from the speaker. This is Admiral Gotthold Riefenstahl, Graf von Basaltberg, commanding His Majesty's ship Vergeltung. I apologize for the inconvenience of our rendezvous point, but I'm sure you can appreciate that our presence in the Confederacy must be kept very quiet so as to avoid alerting our quarry.
I understand completely, Admiral, Clegg assured him.
I was starting to wonder if Captain Kane had decided that tracking you down would be a good test of our patience.
He is certainly not above such tests, Basaltberg agreed with a smile. But in this case, he recognizes, as do I, that time is of the essence.
He tells me you have discovered the location of the traitor Jensen's base?
Traitor. Travis noted the word with interest. Clearly, there was more going on than Kane had told them.
We do,
Clegg confirmed.
Has he also described the quid pro quo we're asking in exchange for that information?
He has, Basaltberg said. He also suggests you have doubts that an admiral and noble of the Andermani Empire would listen to a lowly freighter captain.
I'll admit to having some reservations, yes, Clegg said. Though to be fair, I also had certain reservations about just how lowly a freighter captain he truly was.
Clearly you have the gift of insight, Captain,
Basaltberg said, his smile fading into seriousness.
I have personally known many freighter captains who would say and do whatever would maximize their profits. But I think you will find, his eyes flicked to his side, that in this case, your reservations were unnecessary.
The comm screen split in half, and Captain Kane appeared beside the Admiral. But he was no longer wearing the utilitarian coveralls he'd worn during their meeting aboard Haman. Now, he was dressed in a version of the same uniform Basaltberg wore.
Permit me to introduce Major Qianlu Zhao,
Basaltberg said.
Director of Silesian Operations for Abteilung III, our Department of Intelligence.
He smiled wryly.
He is also my son-in-law. He believes that a joint operation between our two forces would be a good and proper idea.
As do we, Admiral,
Clegg said calmly, to Travis's somewhat grudging admiration. The surprises were coming fast here, and she was taking each of them in stride.
And as you said, time is of the essence.
Time and information both, Basaltberg agreed. Now, Major Zhao tells me that your request in return for Jensen's location is our aid in capturing his base's computer intact.
He leaned forward a few centimeters.
I believe we can work with that.
Chapter 30.
So much work,
Commodore Charnay said, shaking his head.
So few results.
Yes,
Lisa murmured, as she ran her eye down the list of serial numbers, manufacturers, buyers, and destinations. The analysts had been sifting through the possibilities for 2.5 weeks, and about all they'd been able to say with certainty was that much of equipment the RMN had blown into pieces during the Battle of Manticore had been made by Haven manufacturers and sold to buyers in Silesia, which everyone had mostly already known.
Still, it hasn't been a complete waste,
Marcello offered.
A couple of the Silesian buyers are almost certainly general importers who then resell to their clients. If we can dig into their records, we may be able to track the nodes to their ultimate destination. Unless the final transfer was done off the books,
Charnay pointed out.
It probably wouldn't have been in the case of a reasonably honest mercenary like Gustav Andermann used to be. But that doesn't exactly describe your friend Tamerlane. There are dishonest arms brokers in every Star Nation, and that's the sort he'd be dealing with. You can certainly try to find his suppliers, but I'm guessing you'll hit a dead end every time.
You may be right, Marcello said.
But that decision will be someone else's headache, not mine.
Regardless, we greatly appreciate your help.
Glad to do it,
Charnay said.
I've been assured that we'll continue to dig into things at this end after you leave. Tamerlane probably isn't another Brotherhood cult leader, but then again, he might be the beginning of one. It's in Haven's best interests to get a handle on him, and whatever his long-term plans are.
He glanced at his Unilink.
Excuse me, please, I have a screen coming in.
He raised the Unilink to his lips.
Charnay, he's right about the wheels spinning, Marcello said quietly to Lisa. And I doubt the Admiralty is going to be overjoyed at the cost-per-datum ratio we've racked up this trip.
Everyone knew it was a long shot, sir, Lisa reminded him. And we did confirm they're somewhere in Silesia.
We confirmed they were somewhere in Silesia, Marcello countered. That doesn't mean they're there now. The Brotherhood was famous for moving their whole infrastructure around with them. Tamerlane wouldn't have to be a cultist leader to take a page or two from their book.
True, Lisa conceded. So do we head home or wait and let the analysts take another run at the data?
Marcello pursed his lips.
Excuse me, Captain. Commander.
Charnay broke in, his voice suddenly grim.
Something's come up. They need us in Command 1 right away.
Command 1 was 4 floors up in the enormous octagon building which housed the central nervous node of the Republic of Haven's military. It was also down what seemed like the better part of no more than 10 or 12 kilometers of corridors from the conference room in which they'd been working, and the lengthy trek put the difference between the Octagon and the Manticoran Admiralty's far more modest housing into stark contrast. Commodore Charnay led them through the bustling command center and into a smaller, secure briefing room on the other side.
I tell you, I don't know who they are!
The older of the two men seated in the witness chairs growled, his eyes flashing at the semicircle of Havenite officers gathered around a large conference table as Lisa, Marcello, and Charnay slipped into the room.
All I know is that Master Baird has been a prisoner of these criminals for 6 months, and someone has to do something about it.
A Havenite officer wearing Admiral's insignia on his collar and the name Dorvel on his nameplate spotted the newcomers.
Ah, Commodore,
he spoke up, his voice grim as he beckoned to Charnay.
Welcome to Hell's Little Hector. This is Captain Lionel Katura, fresh in from the Walther system over in Silesia. He tells us that his employer, a Solarian merchant named Max Baird, has been captured by a gang of pirates.
Not captured, kidnapped, Katura corrected tersely.
Captured makes it sound like Master Baird was attacking them or provoking them. He wasn't. We were reaching out to the Silesians as per Master Robotham's instructions when we were attacked. Attacked!
Who's Master Robotham?
Charnay asked.
Master Rafe Robotham,
the man in the second chair said. Unlike Katura, he spoke with a Havenite accent and had the look and posture of a civilian.
Salarian merchant, quite well off. He opened a local office on Danik Alpha 12T years ago. I met him myself on one of my regular business trips to Danik. According to our records, he's only been there a couple of times himself, but it's used by his sales and marketing agents whenever they're in the area.
This is Dival Weissman,
Dorvel put in as Charnay raised an eyebrow.
He's our representative on the Gerier Consortium Board, major development group,
he added to Lisa and Marcello.
They're doing a lot of work in the Danik system.
I see,
Charnay said.
And we know for a fact that Captain Katura is one of Master Robotham's people?
Of course, Weissman said, bristling a little.
The system authorities always check ship credentials, as do the consortium's security personnel. Besides, they have the entry passcodes.
No offense, Mr. Weissman, Charnay soothed. This whole kidnapping thing sounds so incredible, I wanted to make sure we had some actual facts nailed down. If you think that's incredible, wait till you hear what the pirates want,
Dorvel said grimly.
A moment more, if I may, Admiral,
Charnay said.
Mr. Weissman, you say you've met Master Robotham. Have you also met Master Baird?
Not personally, but several of my colleagues have,
Weissman said.
He was last through the system about 3T years ago, and I believe he's on record then as saying he was on his way to the Silesian Confederacy.
He gestured to Katura.
At any rate, when Captain Katura came to us with the horrible news, I knew we had to talk to the Navy right away.
You see, they're coming, Katura said. The pirate gang, all of them, and they're bringing 2 battle cruisers and probably 6 heavy cruisers with them.
Lisa felt her eyes go wide. A pirate gang had a pair of battle cruisers?
To Danik, he means, not Haven,
Weissman hastened to add.
Master Baird apparently told them that there were some top-of-the-line League missiles coming into our shipyards and—
Wait a minute, wait a minute,
Charnay interrupted, flashing a startled look at Dorvel.
League missiles are being sent to Danik?
No, of course not,
Weissman said before the Admiral could respond.
What would Gerier be doing with missiles?
But Master Baird had to tell them something,
Katura put in, his voice edging toward pleading.
They had his whole family, his wife and both daughters. The pirate's leader, he calls himself Admiral Swenson, somehow got it into his head that Master Robotham has connections with some of the League's major arms manufacturers. The pirates think he's been selling weapons to the Andermani and getting rich off of Emperor Gustav's building program.
and the ransom demand was that some advanced missile systems be installed on their ships, too. So Master Baird spun them the story about missiles already being on their way.
Does Robotham have such connections?
Charnay asked.
Not that we're aware of, Weissman said.
If he did, though, I suppose it might be logical for him to use local contacts in Danek to actually warehouse or even install them.
He shrugged.
The consortium's been expanding its shipyards, but we're ahead of projections and don't really need all the capacity we've got right now. Consignment work is a way to use that overcapacity rather than letting it stand idle, and we've been doing a fair bit of local shipbuilding and overhaul work. If Robotham really was going to install missile systems for someone, Danek would be a good place to do it.
It doesn't matter whether Master Robotham really has munitions contacts or not, Keturah bit out. The point is that Master Baird had no choice but to promise whatever Swenson wanted or watch his family be tortured to death.
Lisa felt a shiver run up her back. Fleetingly, she wished that Breakwater and all those other anti-Navy people who thought the galaxy was an inherently safe place could hear this.
So as I said, he told them that there were some missiles and upgraded launchers en route to Danek, Keturah continued, and that for a reasonable fee, the Danek government would look the other way while they were misdirected to Swenson's ships. But he also said the shipyard people would refuse unless they had authorization from the Gerier office here in Nouveau-Paris.
Why would they believe that? Charnay asked.
According to Master Baird's recorded message, Swenson believes Robotham brought the missiles in openly through the Republic's inspectors,
Weissman explained.
That's not as ridiculous as it sounds, given the Danek government's stakeholder position in the consortium. We've got a 12% interest, and nobody on the Gerier side would want us to think they were involved in black market arms sales. So it makes sense for them to insist that Robotham bring them in only with our knowledge.
Yes, exactly, Keturah said. That was the only way Master Baird could convince Swenson to let me come ahead. He said that the office here had to sign off on the missile's release. I'm supposed to deliver Master Baird's authorization here, then race back to Danek.
But Master Baird was smart enough to tell them none of this would work unless he came along personally to confirm the orders in Danek,
Weissman said.
And he insisted his family accompany him as well.
Aboard one of these pirate battle cruisers, no doubt,
Charnay growled.
No, I don't think so, Keturah said. Master Baird and his family were traveling aboard Pacemaker, but we were in company with Banshee, one of Master Robotham's freighters. When Swenson sent me with Pacemaker, Master Baird insisted on moving to Banshee instead of one of Swenson's ships.
He took a shuddering breath.
These pirates are brutal, Commodore. We've heard about cases in which their captives have been beaten, raped, tortured, even killed. Master Baird wasn't going to have that happen to his family, and he threatened to blow up Pacemaker and Banshee and kill everyone aboard rather than put his wife and daughters in their hands.
Gutsy move, Charnay said.